Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars.
My name is Allison Encero, your host for today's Not So Different podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. Today I'm speaking with Robin Feldman, the author of Drugs, Money, and Secret Handshakes, The Unstoppable Growth of Prescription Drug Prices. Professor Feldman, welcome to Not So Different.
It's a pleasure to be here with you.
You use a number of analogies in your book to describe the relationships among pharmacy benefit managers, insurers, and drug manufacturers. And one of them relates craft beer to Budweiser, and later you say that if PBMs are to bar owners, then prohibition is on the horizon. And right as your book is about to launch in April of 2019, PBM executives are apparently scheduled to be joining the parade that is currently happening in Congress with executives from Cigna, CVS, Humana, Optum Rx, and Prime Therapeutics agreeing to appear next month before the Senate Finance Committee. Have we hit that moment in America when it comes to prescription drug prices for the consumer, as well as issues about competition for new market entries? And do you think anything tangible will result from the flurry of hearings, as well as some actions that have been taken by the administration?
The PBM business model is going to have to change. The question is, will it be replaced with something better? That's the question in front of us. But with so much pressure in the public forum and on the Hill and the many proposals that are out there, it is going to be different.
We know that change usually only happens incrementally, but is there a larger role for government here, whether it's more of what we've seen from HHS and CMS, like the effort to get rid of rebates in Medicare, or should the FTC step in here and do something different?
I'm a strong believer in competition and in markets, but markets have to be fair, transparent, and efficient. Government cannot be everywhere. We need the market participation. We need the eyes of the market. And a number of the proposals out there will help us get to the type of open competition that we would like. One thing that I believe is important about all the proposals out there is that it's going to take a number of proposals. One single change isn't going to get us the type of market competition that will help drive down the prices that you and I see when we pick up our medications and that we pay when we have to pay for premiums and, of course, the dollars we have to pay for taxes. It's going to take a variety of changes to get us to the type of efficient marketplace that's possible.
Biosimilars, as you know, have not made inroads in the United States the way they have in Europe, due in large part to some of the issues you describe in your book involving patents and formulary issues, such as favorable placement for biologics. One of the solutions you talk about in your book is a one-and-done approach for patent thickets. Will that approach work for biosimilars?
The problem that I talk about and try to address with one-and-done is the following. Drug companies have become expert at extending their protections on a particular drug by piling on protections over and over again. That extends the period of time in which they can block generics or biosimilars out. And in addition, it gives them the volume positions so that they can strike deals with the PBM middle players and hospitals and sometimes doctors, so that when the generics and biosimilars get to market, they can't get a foothold. They can get very little traction in the market. So one and done is an approach to try to limit this. Let me give you one perspective on how extensive the problem is, and I'll give it in the context of generic drugs rather than biosimilars. So in the generic drug context, my research shows that 3/4 of the drugs associated with new patents at the FDA are not new drugs coming on the market. They're existing drugs. So instead of seeing new innovation, we're seeing minor changes to existing drugs that may not have much therapeutic benefit. What we're seeing is minor adjustments to existing drugs changes in dosage or delivery system that may not have much therapeutic benefit at all. They do, however, have the effect of blocking out the generics and the biosimilars from getting to the market. The problems have been particularly intense in the biosimilar market because it's very difficult to cut through the patent thickets that are out there and to work through our very complex legislative patent dance and regulatory patent dance to actually get to market here. And you can compare the U.S. to the European market to see how much more success they've had in getting biosimilars out there. So going back to what you asked me about one and done, the concept is essentially that a new drug, the basics of that new drug, the formula, the chemical, the core, the biologic, that should have one period of protection and not lots and lots of periods of protection. And you can let the drug company pick which one it would like when it finally gets approval. Maybe it's most valuable patent. Maybe its patent has the longest time left to run. Perhaps one of its exclusivities, like an orphan drug exclusivity. It needs to pick one period of exclusivity, and when the time ends, it ends, and then the follow-on drugs can come in and bring the price down. That is the way that the patent system was designed, that it should come to an end at some point. We just haven't seen this because of the incentives built into our system.
We also have a system whereby a manufacturer can get additional patents for additional indications.
And that's also what I was talking about before. You can get additional protections. You can get new patents for new indications. But frankly, companies don't even need to go to that much trouble. A company can look at its patent and decide, oh, that patent actually covers a new use, and then it can plunk that new use down in the FDA's recording system, and it's called the Orange Book, and then drugs that want to come on the market as a generic have to try to deal with that, and they have to show that they are not going to violate that patent. In technical terms, it's called certified to that patent. So there are many ways that companies can extend their protections or make it difficult for another drug company to compete.
The issue of drug costs is getting the attention of some employer groups. And interestingly, a large union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 1500, filed a class action lawsuit against AbbVie for alleged use of a patent thicket to maintain a monopoly for the brand name drug Humira. The complaint also alleges that AbbVie and biosimilar competitors colluded to divide the market in Europe and the United States. Will we see more of this happen, do you think? And if not, why wouldn't stakeholders, like employers, who are responsible financially, not want to get involved?
Employers are key players in this particular game because they are really carrying the brunt of much of the high prices in the system. They're the ones that are paying a significant share of the premiums, and they also have to worry about whether what they can provide is attractive enough to their employees and whether they can afford jobs based on what they have to provide. So employers are really in a difficult position, and they're motivated to try to fix the problem. What's so interesting about the suit you mentioned is that it has a variety of antitrust components. In particular, an aspect of that suit accuses the company of what's called a pay-for-delay suit and of dividing up markets by pay-for-delay agreements. Pay-for-delay is something we've heard a great deal about in the small molecule drug market, not the biologics and biosimilars. But in the small molecule market, in a pay-for-delay deal, the brand company pays the generic a sum, and the generic agrees to stay off the market for a period of time rather than competing. This has been a problem that government has tried to address over and over again, and it's a persistent problem that hasn't gone away. The early deals were simple cash deals. We'll just pay you. the new deals are much more sophisticated, and they can involve multiple settlements in different cases and deals across different drugs. Very difficult to tease out the money flow and to bring a lawsuit. What's interesting about the case you talked about is that this is the first antitrust case I'm aware of that alleges pay-for-delay issues within the biosimilar context. So this could be an important precedent-setting case.
The pay-for-delay issue in the small molecule space is one of the things that happened with drugs like epinephrine and insulin, correct?
There have been pay-for-delay cases across a variety of drugs. Part of the problem with pay-for-delay is that it can be difficult to actually find the settlements. There is legislation that requires that when brand and generic companies settle a lawsuit between them, they have to report that to the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission has all that individual data, but it only reports it in terms of aggregate data, and it doesn't report it in terms of the individual companies. So sometimes you can see this if it comes out in a particular court case and you can trace it. But a lot of the times, it's very difficult for researchers outside of the Federal Trade Commission to know where the pay-for-delay settlements are. But these can be extraordinarily lucrative settlements. So if you have a blockbuster drug that's making billions of dollars a year, even 6 months of delay can mean $500 million in unchallenged sales or more. Pay for delay pays, and companies have made a lot of money using that.
Would it take legislation to make the FTC incumbent up to reveal this transparent information, or to make it prohibitive to bury that sort of information in an aggregate amount?
So I think transparency in general is extraordinarily important. It's important for making sure, as I mentioned before, that our markets are fair and efficient. You need not just the government's eyes, but you need the eyes of the market to tell you what's going on. Right now, our markets are flying blind. Agencies such as the Federal Trade Commission and the FDA could mandate much more transparency than we have right now, or Congress could legislate that those agencies or others are required to have transparency. All of those would be important steps forward for a fair and transparent and efficient market.
So two ways, either legislation or by an internal regulation, is what you're saying.
Exactly. You could do it by regulation. You could do it by legislation. Either way, getting information into the market would be a very good shot in the arm for competition.
The first part of your book, you discuss a lot about drug prices, list prices, the average wholesale price, and how that plays into the rebates that are used by pharmacy benefit managers, drug manufacturers, and insurers in that web. This week, Eli Lilly disclosed in an annual report that their Humalog list prices grew 52% over 5 years, but after taking into account discounts and rebates, they were saying that net prices fell 8% over the same time frame. Does that really matter in the end?
Well, when you look at the numbers, you have to think where we've come from. So if the price has been driven sky high and then you have a step backwards, you're still in sky high land. But let me give you a couple of other ways in which the numbers really matter. So drug companies do like to point out that they have rebates and that the actual net price is lower after all of the rebates to the health plans. Now, of course, the individual patients don't see those rebates because those rebates come in the form of aggregate checks well after the patient has filled medication. So you and I will never see those rebates, at least not directly. The other problem, and this is a big problem for American patients and consumers, is that many of us pay that high list price, the price before the rebate. So, for example, 30% of the plans through employers are set up so that the patient has to pay 100% up until they meet a certain deductible. That 100% is based on the high list price. So we're paying for that high list until the deductible is met. Other plans, particularly in Medicare, have coinsurance. That means that even after you hit your deductible, you have to pay a percentage of the cost. That coinsurance is based on the list price. It's not based on the rebate price. So those big high numbers matter. And of course, many people don't have prescription drug coverage, even if they have health insurance. And many people still don't have health insurance. So a lot of patients, a lot of citizens do pay those very high list prices. And again, I would go back to saying, when you look at the numbers and say whether they've come down, whether they've come up, you have to ask, you have to look across time. So let me give you one perspective on Medicare and then one directly with the insulin manufacturers themselves. So even after rebates, Medicare spending for brand name drugs, just the brand name drugs, still rose 62% in the 5 years between 2011 and 2015. Most people are not bringing home 62% more salary than they did 5 years before, and most budgets don't have room for that as well. We were talking directly about insulin, though, and insulin products are a classic example of drugs with extended protections. So insulin, the core drug, has been around for close to 100 years, and according to my research, all of the top-selling insulin drugs have increased their protection by at least 20 years. Each of them have piled on dozens of protections, as many as 55. That is not how the system is designed to operate. And it's not just in insulin. So you can look at the drug Lyrica. Diabetics use that to treat nerve pain. Company extended the protection cliff by almost a decade with 16 additions. These are not outliers. This is business as usual in the drug industry.
The issue of drug pricing appears to be bipartisan right now, but do you think that the current Congress has the appetite and the will to take this issue head on?
I believe the current Congress is looking for solutions. They are feeling the heat. The question is, will they be able to make the hard choices that will make a difference in the long run? Can they get the changes that it will take, both large and small, so that we actually see real change in drug prices and the way the system works? That will take extraordinary political will, and there is a lot of money flowing into Congress.
What about the argument from the side of manufacturers and others that say, well, you know, look at what we have done in terms of cutting-edge treatments and possibly curative treatments for cancer. We need that sort of funding to help create innovation and invention.
I always like to start by saying that the pharmaceutical industry has brought extraordinary advances in this country. And when they do that, they should be handsomely rewarded. However, once that period of protection ends, a drug company should go back to the bench and find new innovations. That's how the system is supposed to work, and that's really not how the system is working right now. When you have minor tweaks in dosage or delivery system or usage or chemical modification, those changes generally don't cost anywhere near what it takes to find a new drug and the R&D related to a new drug. But we are still lavishing those rewards for minor changes. So we are getting a lot of drugs, but we're not necessarily getting the kind of innovation that we need and that we should be incentivizing. I'd also like to address something else that is underneath what you were saying about we need to have these high drug prices because we need drug companies to have the incentive to go out and to look for expensive new drugs. Again, it goes back to what the patent system is supposed to do. The patent system is supposed to give companies an opportunity to gain a reward when they are successful. But a patent is not a participation trophy. You are only supposed to get that reward when you are successful. So I'm always uncomfortable when drug companies try to, for example, fold in into the cost of research and development the cost of their failures. We want to incentivize people to succeed and to get there as efficiently as possible. They should be rewarded when they succeed, not rewarded when they fail, and it shouldn't be folded into the reward for the successes.
And why did you decide to write this book?
I was watching prices rise in the drug industry and trying to understand why. It didn't make economic sense, and so I determined to try to figure out what was happening, to peel back the layers and to see what was going on. That's what prompted me to write this book. As I was doing it, I also realized that there needed to be simple, accessible explanations of what's going on so people could see it. And at the end of the day, what I saw as the two main drivers of drug prices are the following. One are the secret deals between the drug companies and the PBM middle players and other middle players in the systems like doctors and hospitals. And second are the patent walls that drug companies can build to keep generics out and to drive patients into higher priced drugs. It's the combination of those two things, the secret deals and the patent walls, that are driving the prices you and I have to pay day in, day out.
Is there anything else you want people to know about this topic?
I think the last thing I would say is that this is an area in which individual voices do matter. There is extraordinary lobbying power within the pharmaceutical industry, but you can also see the effects of individual citizens reaching out at the state and at the federal level to the people who represent them to say, this matters to me. I'd like to see real change. That gives an opportunity to allow representatives from both sides of the aisle to come together and to try to address the problem.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it here at the Center for Biosimilars.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Not So Different. If you'd like to learn more about Professor Feldman's book, visit our show notes, where we'll have a link to purchase. As always, if you like the podcast, rate us at iTunes. Until next time, thanks for listening to Not So Different.